Digital 410 Media proudly presents the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast with your hosts, Don Abernathy, Jeff Copsetta, and Dennis Blocker.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast, your favorite World War II-based podcast. And now is that time of year. Happens every year, but now is the 80th time it's happened, and that is the 80th anniversary of D-Day. That's coming up today, right now, as you hear this. It is the 80th anniversary of D-Day. And let me tell you, for the first time ever, I don't have fear of missing out. I am missing out. I'm seeing all these video clips. I'm seeing all these pictures of all of our friends over in Europe. They're all torn to battlefields. Jeff's over in Greece. You're stuck in Texas. I'm stuck in Florida. So Dennis and I are holding down the fort. But shout out to Jeff. I don't know if things have been crazy around my house lately. I don't know if I've been operating an autopilot and things just, I don't remember doing stuff. No lie, Dennis, I looked at my phone today and I remember downloading the photo of Jeff putting the sticker on the slab with all the other stickers. And Jeff's not out vandalizing Greece, but he did contribute a sticker to a bunch of other stickers. And so we do have a What's the Scuttlebutt sticker on a monument with other stickers in Greece. I'm looking at my phone today and I have this video in my gallery, not in my Google Drive, in my gallery on my phone of Jeff standing next to a tank talking about exclusive content that I do not remember downloading, don't know where it came from. Jeff's by no means the tech geek, that's my job. Somehow this video ended up on my phone, which I promptly posted it on Instagram and Facebook, but I don't remember downloading it. Once again, I could be just operating on no sleep or whatever, but I do not remember downloading that video. Somehow it's in my phone. So let that be a heads up and a warning for you guys. If you haven't done so, head over to WTSPWorldWar2.com. Sign up, subscribe for Patreon. Look, I don't want to use the word.
I mean, that's how amazing you are, man. You're even downloading things in your sleep that are pertinent and that are amazing content. That's pretty awesome, actually. Great attribute.
Well, thank you. We don't consolidate our patrons. There's some pages that do. Oh, you pay $500 a month, which there are YouTube videos where people are asking people to pay. Tell me you grew up poor without telling me you grew up poor. Never in your wildest dream having the audacity to ask a Patreon member to pay you $500 a month. Yeah, no thanks. I'm not going to ask you guys to pay half my mortgage. Actually, not now that I had to refinance to get this water. But anyhow, yeah, I've seen YouTube channels where they're asking people to pay $500. Look, it don't matter if you pay the dollar a month, the $350 a month, or the $750 a month. You get access to the same quality stuff. And right now with the inflation, we get it if you want to do the dollar a month. The only difference between those three tiers is if you do sign up for the $750 a month, you do get a free t-shirt or an item of equivalent value off of our shop after the third month. Other than that, I don't say, well, you only pay a dollar a month, you don't get to see this video. No. Regardless of how much you pay, you get access to exclusive content. And Jeff is recording content in Greece right now that we will not put up on our free YouTube channel. This is going to be content as our way to thank. And trust me, we owe you all some thanks because there was quite a while there we weren't staying up on the content on the Patreon just because we were trying to get the regular content out. But here, I do want to make this announcement. Shout out to Dennis. And shout out to Mike, no use for a last name, who is the co-host on my other podcast, the What's in Your Head podcast. They have stepped up and offered to help me edit video for their appropriate podcast. So Dennis is going to help me take every interview we do, I record the video, but I'm too busy editing audio and everything else. I don't have enough time, plus my full-time job and everything else. So Dennis is now going to help me with editing the What's in Your Head podcast. We're going to take these full two-hour-long interviews, episodes, and we'll probably cut them into three or four 15, 20 minute little segments, put them up on YouTube, not for the Patreon. We will make some more Patreon exclusive content out of that, but we will take a lot of it and put it up on YouTube to provide people a way to see what's going on in the studio. And plus, it's a way to try to entice people who don't know who we are, who might happen to see one of these clips on YouTube, to come join us and download a podcast. But thanks to Mike, thanks to Dennis, they're helping increase production here at Digital 410 Media. So shout out to you guys. That's been help I've been looking for 5 years. So shout out to you guys. But yeah, head over to Patreon, sign up, subscribe, it's a dollar a month. But how about you, fella? Are you seeing these videos of, like, you got the Band of Brothers cast, they're out there jumping with one group. You got Round Canopy Jump Team. We got our friends, you know, over at We Have Ways podcast. They're doing cool stuff. We have all these different World War II podcasts are just, they're just better. Well, to be fair, We Have Ways lives over there, so it's not like they had to book a, you know, transatlantic flight to get over there. But still, it's like, this is for what we do. This is our 50th Super Bowl, if you will. This is our mega one, and we're in the rear of the gear. Are you feeling that way right now, or is it just me?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No, I don't even like looking at that content because I get super jealous, and it's a superhuman emotion that is, yeah. And you know, my great grandpa is buried in Henri Chapelle there in Belgium. And so I've got places I could stay. I've got Belgian friends, Dutch friends, who would come in contact with every week. And the Mears family, Robbie and Frankie, they're the ones that Robbie adopted my great grandpa's grave, Frank Sobin. He was in the 30th Infantry. He's buried in Henri Chapelle. So, you know, and then Arlen Adams is, I believe, Dutch. He's got a World War II Jeep he's restored, and he puts all these amazing content over there. And he just all about the infantry, and they're just so excited. All these folks are coming out there. And I know that if I went, I would have had this amazing opportunities. But, you know, sometimes you just got to say, you know, maybe an off year is better.
So funny you said that, because I was letting your comment breathe, and I was gonna say, you know, Dennis and I, we could sit here and be like these elitists, say, well, you know, there's too many, you know, sunny days fans over there, real aficionados. We go in the off year when it's not full of tourists and these Johnny come latelys who just want to show up for the, no, we'd be lying. We want to be there.
Oh, yeah.
If we could be there right now, there. We would be there with our tourist cap on saying, la-da-da, look at us. Just completely offending everybody with our lack of, you know, learning the language and just walking around. Hey, let's go. You know, it would be the equivalent of going to Italy and then asking for do you know what a cappuccino is? But yeah.
I wish I was over there being obnoxious right now. And
I've never, with the exception of my recent trip to the Bahamas and 20 years ago, my cruise to Cozumel, Mexico, I've never left the continental United States.
Oh, wow.
So I've never even left our hemisphere at this point.
I was pretty lucky, military kid. I got to live in Iceland and Guam, but I don't remember Guam, but Iceland was awesome.
I do work remote. I do work with three remote employees now, all of them in the Philippines, but they're not on the good island. I mean, in the island where the war broke out, they're further down south. But yeah, it would be nice to get them to, you know, get me some cool content from down there, but.
Well, Jeff had a great opportunity, didn't he, to go and hang out with the Band of Brothers guys and Scott Gibson, I think. Mm-hmm. And
he always gets to do the cool stuff. I guess maybe because it's centrally located, all the things he knows. I'm down here in the ass crack of Florida. So, he definitely has access to the cooler stuff. But we're happy for him. He's
super stoked.
Great once-a-lifetime chance. And he's bringing us, as we talked about a few weeks ago, content that very few shows talk about, and that is, you know, the contribution of the Greece people, their military, and their the huge ass whooping, not quite honestly, which we found out that they personally handed over to the Weimar Republic and the Nazi regime, and how they're actually credited to possibly shorten the European theater campaign by the amount of effort and work they did in such a small landmass island. The amount of effort they did is just amazing, and it's so cool that he actually got the opportunity to go to some museums. And apparently, you know, I would assume, you know, kind of like how you could walk into an autograph session and have, you know, an in with the authors because you're of that same ilk. Jeff is a museum. He's a museum guy, so he can walk into the museum, he can look at them, and they know, oh, come on, full tour, come on. So apparently, absolutely, he's setting up the camera. He's getting some backstage access, and so that content will be heading over to our Patreon page. So yeah, we're looking forward to that. So Dennis and I are going to hang out with you guys shortly, but we were discussing One of the things I've been proud of, and I wish happens more, but unfortunately, as time marches on, these opportunities are dwindling. I have been reaching out to some people I find here and there on social media, or at least to their contacts. So what we're going to do is we're going to talk to you guys briefly, and then we're just going to let as the phrase I like that we don't use enough, but it's on our website, is those who are there. We're going to allow those who are there to tell their side of the story. So for the 80th anniversary of D-Day, after Dennis and I get done bloviating about whatever nonsense we're going to hit you guys with, we're going to cut to truncated clips of the interviews that I've done over the last 5 years with some veterans and let them present to you their story through their eyes and their very own words of their contribution to the war effort. We just thought, what a better way to commemorate the 80th anniversary than to let these guys share it in their words.
Yeah, for sure.
Gotta say, fella, have you like just turned your back on the bearded community altogether? I know you shaved for a living history event, which is very commendable. I do every time. If you see me with a dyed head and a shaved face, that means I got a living history event coming up. But as soon as that shit's over, my beard's growing back. You're holding on to the strong beard look, huh?
Yeah, I've had a lot of comments from family members and some of the ladies. So
we got to.
I turned 50 in a couple days.
Well, happy birthday!
Yeah,
on the 8th, I just always assumed you were younger than me.
Yeah. And God, you know, I appreciate God very much. He gave me a huge wink, knowing my love of World War II history. Had my daughter Brooke born on D-Day, June 6th. So he gave
when's
me
your
a
birthday?
Hmm?
When's your birthday?
June 8th.
So your daughter's June 6th.
Yeah.
Yours June 8th. Mine's June 29th. So we're canceled.
Jeff is June 3rd.
So we have, yeah. 4th. His yeah. Yeah. His wife just shouted a happy birthday to him. So we are June heavy on the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast. I actually turned 46 this month. So I just assumed you were always younger than me. I know Jeff was, but you.
Yeah.
Okay. We're going to get off World War II for just a second because I got to ask this question. And if you're in your 40s, you're probably going to have the same question. And it happened to me again last night. I was watching Greg Gutfeld on YouTube because I cut the cord, and he had a guest on there, and he's actually I think the Fox and Friends Weekend one of their hosts, and his mom was in the audience, and they're busting his balls, and he said, well, my mom's been putting up with me for 45 years. And I said to myself the same thing I always say to myself is, do I look that old? Every time I see somebody in there, and once again, I just assume you're younger than me, so this don't apply to you either. Now, I have the gray beard, but I start growing gray at 16. And so the gray makes me look older than I am, but there's been so many times I've been watching TV, and I'm like, do I look that old? And here's the perfect – you ever watch the reruns of Roseanne?
Uh-huh, sure.
You know how old Dan and Dan and Rosie were on that show?
Mm-mm.
How old do you think they were?
I would say 38.
They were 32.
Jeez.
You know how old? Okay. Hold on to this one. You ready? I got freebie. I've been watching All in the Family. 1971, Archie and Edith.
Sure.
Do you know how old Carol O'Connor was when he started playing Archie Bunker? White hair.
51.
42. Carol O'Connor, Archie Bunker, the crotchety old man who yells at Meathead, is younger than me. If you go and obviously the old one, the one from the 80s, Cocoon, the guy who diabetes and he used to do the oatmeal commercials. You know how old he was when he did Cocoon? The movie about the senior citizens who become spry after swimming with alien eggs. They were all ready to die in the retirement home. He was 55 in that movie. So once again, I ask you, do I look that old?
No, I do that all the time.
Yeah.
I can't believe it. I'm like, man.
I was watching a TikTok a few years back, and this woman was... She showed a picture that she found from Time was either Time or Life magazine from like 1956. And she was showing these women, these wives, who were all in their 40s. And no, I think they're like 38, maybe 40. And she was like 45. And she's like, she was talking about how much older they, she's like, every one of these ladies looks 60. What was going on in 1950? I'm like, they're all 38, 1950. That means they grew up during the Great Depression. And yeah. They saw their brothers, their husbands, their boyfriends, their fathers, their cousins, all the boys in their towns go off to war and die. They didn't have all the preservatives in their food. They didn't have plastic surgery. That's called hard living and stress. That's why they all look 60 when they're in their 40s.
Yeah, for sure.
It's like, and we take it all for granted. But yeah, I just like, I don't look that old, do I?
So, no, we don't.
Happy birthday to you, Jeff. Happy birthday to you coming up. Happy birthday to your daughter. And happy birthday to myself. And then my daughter was born on July 3rd. So her birthday's coming up. And then Carrie's is coming up in August. But before we get to the past interviews, you got anything you want to talk about or briefly discuss before we move on?
Yeah, I was flipping around YouTube today, just kind of checking out the D-Day stuff. And there were some young guys that were playing a video game called Hell Let Loose. It's a open world video game, and there's 100 players, so it's 50 on 50. And technology has advanced to the point where you can actually do that now, and you can go in real time, and it's pretty significant, awesome.
Is that the game that, let me back up, my brother and I were both really huge Battlefield fans. I played Call of Duty back in the day, but as Call of Duty got more into like Fortnite realm, I've always played Battlefield 2, but as the name implied, Battlefield was more realistic as far as realistic as a game could get. The gun sounds were more realistic. The fact that, you know, it actually had Kentucky windage and all that. But I always told my brother, I said, you know, it'd be sweet. It would be cool if they made a game like Battlefield. But when you come on, you know, much like a real war, you have side A versus side B. Side B may be holding down. Side A has areas they need to get to on this huge Grand Theft Auto size map or bigger. And your jump off date may have been in real time on June 1st. And it's September and that same battle is going on because people haven't progressed across the map. You know, it's like a real life battle where it's not, okay, this is done in 20 minutes where we restart. No, it's like, but I think there is a game now. And this may be the one you're talking about that they're trying to do that now. It's a battle in real time, meaning there's no time limit. It goes until either Team A is completely decimated and all the people either dropped off the server or just completely wiped out, or until their objective is acquired.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. I think that's a pretty awesome concept. It'd be great for the players. I don't know if it'd be really worth watching.
I know, but I think that game you're discussing may be the one that I heard is trying to achieve that sort of level of.
I can see them doing it because they definitely have the mechanics and they've got the software down. It's an absolutely beautiful game. And what struck me today, because they were attacking all across Omaha Beach and they were taking the towns and beyond it. But the view that I had was called God View. And if I know the folks aren't really familiar with that, you know, that Don, you are and yep. all that gamers, but it allows you to look at things from a bird's eye view and you get to see both sides. You get to see where the Germans are moving and you get to see where the Americans are moving. And then you can even, if there's something going on at a crossroads, you can zoom in, look around, you can peek around the corners, you can see what their viewpoint is and why isn't that guy firing at this machine gun nest? And then you get down to his viewpoint and you can see, oh, well, he can't see them because there's a bush and there's a cart in his way. He can't see them.
To clarify that for people listening at home who haven't played video games, I think a more authentic terminology for nowadays, and now keep in mind, when you're watching God mode, you're not participating. You're literally spectating.
Right.
I think a more appropriate phrase would be drone mode, because you can move around the map as if you're watching from a drone, because you're just spectating. It's literally a camera that you can fly around, and as Dennis said, you can go into...
they don't know you're there.
Yeah, well, I'm just saying, for people trying to imagine what God mode is, just imagine a virtual...
sure.
Imaginary drone that just... Wherever you want it to go. Or... XFL started, but the NFL has it now. They got their cameras on the zip line that flies over the field. Same thing.
Sure.
So that's what the God mode allows you to do.
Yeah, and you know that with Don, well, that was pretty really interesting today, and it never really dawned on me, but it made me actually appreciate what our guys and the allies did even more, because you know from being born in 1974 and you know seeing The Longest Day with all those famous actors, and then you know the other war movies that I've seen, you just take it for granted we're gonna win. And the guys are going to push through. They're going to get through the wall. They're going to get it through St. Mary Glees. They're going to, and everything's going to work out. And watching this game today, kind of, it's really odd that it struck me, but I'm appreciative that I did. Watching that today, it was like, man, this this came down to one guy holding the line in some cases, and he had no idea where his help was.
Imagine true realism mode, right? You download the game, you play, you get shot, your game gets deleted off your hard drive because you died. That's it. One and done. That's to be the most realistic version.
that's very true. But that's kind of what I wanted to just say, was that, you know, seeing that hell let loose today, watching guys move around that don't know where all the other players are, and they're having that God view or the drone view where I can see the elements that are coming in and they're reacting to their tank was just blown up. They got the word, and you can see on there, you can actually see that it takes a couple minutes for them to adjust. So you imagine add a couple hours to it in real life. You can see it actually happening. And it was very, very interesting.
Did you ever play Battlefield Online?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever play on a good server with people actually wanted to play?
Like with tactics and stuff? Yeah.
For those of you who have never played Battlefield, and it doesn't happen on all of them, but like I go all the way back to Battlefield 2142. And I know it's a World War II podcast, but just we're going to get to it. The cool thing about Battlefield, which they do not do on Call of Duty, and they don't do it on all the Battlefields, you got to get on a server with people who want to play. There's actually a commander who doesn't play in real time. He looks at the map. And if you have a full server, you'll have four or five squads. And you'll hit squad leader A. And you'll pick a destination on a map. And if you actually have a group of people who want to play, you know, first platoon will head out to that area. Second platoon will head out to that area. And that's why in Battlefield, when you're playing Capture the Flag or whatever, you actually get squad points for actually doing what because the squad leader will do the same thing. So the game commander will tell the squad leader, hey, take your squad there. A squad leader will actually go on his map, choose a destination, tell people to go there. And as their squad goes there and achieves their objective, they get additional points that then help rank up their guns, give them in-game bonuses and things like that. And so when you're on a server with four or five squads of people who truly want to play the game, and as a squad leader, you're telling your squad to go attack this position, and your four guys and your squad do that, and then it just, the whole thing moves along quickly. It's just a lot of times you get on a game and it's people like Call of Duty, and they just will want to do the run and gun lone wolf stuff.
Yeah, and the viewers should know that, like, in that situation you're talking about, that mode, the commander can't see the enemies what they're doing on his map, so
only if they're only relying if they're
on the feedback, which is real life. He's going to be relying on the feedback. Hey, there's very little resistance that we met over here, we've accomplished it. Or hey, we're like taking some severe heavy fire, can you shift some guys over to us? It's pretty
or if the recon guy's looking through his binoculars and see somebody, it'll ping them on that person on the map for like maybe 4.5 seconds, so the commander will see a little red flicker. But yeah, going back to World at War, me, Carrie, Slim, Nikki Picks, and Ebu, we used to play all the time. I used to play so much, I gained like 40 pounds. We would play for hours. We had a 42-game win streak.
Wow.
And kids nowadays won't be able to handle it because we had those maps locked down. And we found – and we did true – I'm putting quotes – it's game. I was never in the military. But compared to what they do in Call of Duty, we did true, quote-unquote, battle tactics where we set up a perimeter. We had a front line. We had guys in the back. And we would quote-unquote camp. That's how we would win. Instead of running and gunning and doing these quick sniper shots and using a sniper like at the, you know, a 1872 Winchester, we had actually used the guns as they were meant to be. You had your M1 Garand. You had your, you know, your your Ma Deuces. We would set up a line of perimeter, and these people would come through, and we would just decimate them. Because you guys are campers, I'm like, show me one field manual that suggests you just run around crazily and shoot from the hip. It doesn't exist. And yeah. Using that true, once again, air quotes, true video game version of military tactics, we would just decimate people because everybody else was just more interested in just running around shooting from the hip. And we would just completely destroy them.
Yeah, I was never any good at that game. And which is why I spectate, but I don't have a quick enough response. And it's just so demoralizing being killed by guys that heckle you with these prepubescent voices. I haven't even hit puberty yet. And they're talking about whacking you.
Yeah, we would affectionately refer to those as squeakers.
Squeakers.
I haven't played an online game in so long.
But getting back to that Hell Let Loose game, as a writer, you always want to look at things from different viewpoints. But how cool is it that young guys, it's a way that are thinking, even thinking about Omaha Beach, and they want to participate 80 years later. They want to participate. They want to be a part of it. And so they immerse themselves. 100 guys from across the world got together on these, and that's just one server. There's hundreds and hundreds of servers. That's pretty awesome when you think about it after all these years.
I completely went blank and I could easily pull up my phone, but I ain't got time. Do you watch that, follow the Instagram page of that young 10-11-year-old kid who he got hooked up with Liberty Phillips and her group, where his mom takes him to all these places? He was at the 82nd Airborne Modern Day Camp and his World War II uniform, like doing their jump towers and like participating in their obstacle courses. And I think he went out with a jump team. I don't know if he actually jumped. I know his mom did, but I know he went through the training and all that stuff.
That's so cool.
I'm so jealous of that kid.
I know.
I think he may be over in Normandy too right now.
Little punk.
Yeah. I know his mom listens too, but yeah, I see his videos. I'm like, this kid is
thankful that those kids have that hunger and that thirst for knowledge and just that love for the history that we do. That's just so encouraging to see. And man, I'm so proud of them out there doing it, getting it done, getting after it. It's awesome.
Absolutely.
Did you see the video of that one kid who was trying to be sponsored for Operation Meatball? And he was hiding behind the leaf stack and he comes running around in his 82nd Airborne Division, uniform, and he's got the helmet and the weapon and this and that, and then it just like oddly cuts to him talking into the camera and he's got this list.
I think it's probably the same kid. I can't remember his name.
The best ever. Like, I just love him so much.
Speaking of which, I need to check my eBay status because I got Masters of the Air Blu-ray on its way. So,
oh my god!
So we can finally talk about it on the show. I know we're behind the curve here, but Jeff pointed out to me and we talked about it and I went on and it's supposed to be the region free. So I'm not supposed to be getting smacked with any like, oh, you don't have the codex. It's a legitimate, not bootleg Craig, anything like that. Masters of the Air. It's shipped. Shipped on June 1st. I don't know where it's coming from.
Man, I can't wait to be able to talk to you about it.
I'll let you guys know before you go drop the money. $21.29. Think about that for a second, you guys. $21.29 for a
pretty good. I remember spending almost $100 for a freaking Band of Brothers when it came out in a gift set and all that.
Blu-ray, not even 1080p Blu-ray box set. The show has only not even been out for a year yet. And as Dennis said, I remember when I worked at the radio station and Haney got me both the Pacific and Band of Brothers for my birthday. Those damn shows of Band of Brothers had already been out for like 18 years. And Pacific had already been out for
$5.
And they were still retailing for $90.
Yeah.
And it's not $90 because it comes with a full double, you know, page
autographed,
double glossy photos of behind. No, it's just posters. It's just four DVDs and a metal tin, $100. The fact that we're getting Masters of the Air for $21.99 is insane. So it should be here soon, hopefully. It shipped on shipped. Yep. Arrives June 13th. So I should have it here next week. So it may be coming from across seas, taking 2 weeks, but they do take returns and it says region free. So I'm not anticipating, and I just want to pop into my Xbox.
Region one, actually.
Well, these are region free, meaning there's no, there's no region. It's,
I thought you said three.
Region free. But yeah, so I'll let you guys know. And if it's on the up and up and the quality's good and this isn't like,
yeah, hopefully it's not Mystery Science Theater.
I was gonna say the same thing. It's not some guy like recording off his TV and you can see his wife walking to the bathroom three times. Oh, those were the days, man. LimeWire, BearShare, Morpheus, downloading bootleg Craig movies. I'm gonna say this, I'm gonna say it right now. I was saying up to a year ago, my computer that I recorded the same podcast with up to a year and a half ago, I was running Windows 7, but it was the 32-bit. But that Windows 7 started out its days as Windows Millennium back in 1999. I kept upgrading my systems because I'm an IT guy, and then I would take it, photocopy it to a larger hard drive, put a new motherboard, do what's called a repair install. But I literally had the same original instance on my computer running from the 90s, late 90s, 2000s, still had programs. Prior to me getting that box set, my band, when I moved to California, because I left Ohio in 2001, my viewing experience of Band of Brothers for the first 15 years were bootleg downloaded versions off of BearShare. It wasn't until 2018 that Haney got me the box set. So I think I saw like the first four episodes on HBO of my roommates, and then I moved to California. I just downloaded the rest of them. So for years, I've been watching the bootleg version, but I finally have official box set version of it. And so excited I finally get to see Masters of the Air. But we want to thank you guys so much for your continued support over the years. Thank you guys so much from me, Dennis, and Jeff. Happy birthday to all of us, and thoughts and prayers to the family members and all those who are still alive who are impacted by World War II, which us Americans, we're not that greatly impacted, but as I'm sure Jeff will attest to when it comes even from Greece, when you're living over on that side of the planet, living in towns and communities that old, there's still scars and there are still memories from people who were 4 years old at the time, people who were 18 at the time, to just the fact that you walk out your apartment building and see bullet pox still in the old plaster that were never replaced. So people are still impacted. Sure. And to that point, people over there are definitely more grateful and reminiscent of the war and the impact that it had on their society and their community.
Soldiers, sailors, and airmen of the Allied Expeditionary Force. You are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you. The hopes and prayers of liberty-loving people everywhere march with you. In company with our brave allies and brothers in arms on other fronts, you will bring about the destruction of the German war machine, the elimination of Nazi tyranny over the oppressed peoples of Europe, and security for ourselves in a free world. Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened. He will fight savagely. But this is the year 1944. Much has happened since the Nazi triumphs of 1940-41. The United Nations have inflicted upon the Germans great defeats in open battle, man-to-man. Our air offensive has seriously reduced their strength in the air, and their capacity to wage war on the ground. Our home fronts have given us an overwhelming superiority in weapons and munitions of war, and placed at our disposal great reserves of trained fighting men. The tide has turned. The free men of the world are marching together to victory. I have full confidence in your courage, devotion to duty, and skill in battle. We will accept nothing less than full victory. Good luck, and let us all beseech the blessing of Almighty God upon this great and noble undertaking.
Mr. Jake Larson.
So we were put in what they called a baloney. I don't know if you ever heard that name.
No.
It's like a ring of baloney, but it's all Quonsets around there. And you could go in on one side, you come out the other all the way through. If anybody in that baloney was classified top secret bigot, B-I-G-O-T, that's the highest classification you could get. And we were working on the invasion. Now, after the war was over, I received the Bronze Star for what I did working on the invasion. Anybody that was top secret bigger in those balloonies, you didn't walk around like anybody else. You were always kept under guard. Bigot was so top secret that you weren't able to be out, walk around with what you knew.
And so you didn't have the luxuries of freedoms that the other soldiers had
anything. You were kept right in there, and when you were there, you worked on the invasion. That's what you did. The day was June 5th.
Yes, correct. June 5th was the original day, and because of bad weather and because the invasion was going to rely heavily on the Pathfinders and the Airborne going in first, you guys had to, and plus, obviously, with ocean tides and the sea levels, the whole thing had to be scrapped and pushed out a day.
That's exactly what happened. Over a month before D-Day, we went back to our units and to get them all ready to move at the invasion. And the British at that time were having an operation, they call it an operation, at Slapton Sands. It was for the benefit of the Americans. They were invited to participate, and Slapton Sands, on the southeast coast of England, between Plymouth and Portsmouth, the landings there were like landing on Omaha Beach. And these special landings, we were supposed to come in there on LSTs, that's landing ship tanks. These landing ship tanks, instead of holding tanks, they held 400 soldiers. The British were going to greet them at Slapton Sands with live fire.
Now, for those listening at home, correct me if I'm wrong, but this Slapton Sands operation was essentially a dress rehearsal to prepare you guys for the D-Day invasion, correct?
Absolutely, yes. So we were going to get a little indoctrination from the British. And there were three of those LSTs, and I happened to be in the left one with 400 of us there. They had armed soldiers and machine guns and everything so that we couldn't be intercepted. There was another one of these landing ship tanks to the right of us. I was very poor at judging distance in the water. I would say half a mile away. And then there was a third one, another half mile farther on. And behind us, there were groups of landing ship tanks, and I think there was 11 in all, but they were in threes coming up there to Slapton Sands. When we got close to Slapton Sands, two German E-boats intercepted us, and they torpedoed the two landing ship tanks on my right, and they shot the heck out of the components that were taking care of the one that I was in. In fact, they shot so much of the stuff that they cut off our air, and we were diesel gassed. 400 of us laying there on the floor vomiting and trying to breathe through wet handkerchiefs. I don't know how we made it back to Plymouth, England. We got down there, and we stumbled out of there, and there was a full bird colonel got us to attention, and he said, under penalty of court-martial, you cannot talk about this even to your commanding officers.
Well, of course, because when the news, if the news would have gotten out that this happen during, as we said, a dress rehearsal, not only would it have been horrible for the Allies and the morale, but it would have been a huge morale boost for the Germans to know the amount of damage they caused. You guys were basically sitting ducks. You really couldn't defend yourselves from the Germans, could you?
We couldn't. We have no way to defend ourselves. We carried the M1 Garand.
Yeah.
Well, it was like a pea shooter.
Well, I often tell people who don't realize that you, when you guys landed and when you're doing these operations, you were essentially wearing your Sunday best. You had on wool trousers, a button-up shirt, boots, and then you just put on some leggings, a helmet, and a haversack and called it a day.
Our main piece of defense was our helmet.
And that pretty much provided you protection from ricochet and flying rocks.
From shrapnel.
Exactly. Do you recall how many lives were lost during the incident at Slapton Sands?
795 people died there. And our army did not tell anyone, the surviving families, that their sons were killed at Slapton Sands. They told them they were killed in the invasion of Europe. I've got also an exciting thing about D-Day, if you want to hear a little bit about that.
I got all the time in the world. I'll sit here for the next 3 hours. You just keep talking, sir.
All right. I was on the command ship, but I landed with the 1st Division.
Big Red One.
The Big Red One. We had the 1st and 29th Divisions under us. We were in charge of Omaha Beach. That's 5th Corps was in charge of Omaha Beach under 1st Army. And 1st Army also had Utah Beach. That was under 7th Corps. And the 4th Division was supposed to come in on Utah Beach. Now, I didn't know this particular until years after that Slapton Sands incident was brought up. But 400 of the ones that were sunk were from Postalap land on Utah Beach. So they had to get another division in there. I don't know today what that division was. And those were guys that landed on Omaha Beach without any warning. That fast.
Wow. What wave did you go in on?
The waves were all screwed up because Omaha Beach, they could not take any more onto the beach because the Germans were defending it so much. We just went around in circles out there. It seemed like forever.
Now, that's a very good point. I want to pause right there real quick. Two things for the listeners at home who aren't up to speed on D-Day. One, part of the battle planning was that the Air Force was going to go in and bomb the beaches, thus making deep craters to provide giant foxholes for you guys to hide from the machine guns. That didn't happen. Most of the pilots were new and they missed the beach, and so you guys didn't have the craters to rely on. But more importantly, you just said you were out there circling for hours and hours. Could you, for those listening at home, imagine, you know, you got your helmet on, you got your 8-pound M1 Garand, you got ammo, you got your belongings in your musette bag or your haversack on your back.
Oh, wait, it was our backpack. 75 pounds we carried. 30 of us in those LSTs.
And so 30 of you are riding around for hours, cramped, can't move, got all this weight on you, and then finally the time comes and they expect you to be able to get up and run through deep water.
It was a flat-bottom boat. It was rough seas. Some of the guys were vomiting, seasick, and there's another blessing I've got. I don't get seasick. And but I got pretty upset.
Sure.
When you see others vomiting.
Those ramps, when they get water wet, were super slick. And so not only have you been sitting there, now you're getting fired upon. You're supposed to get down this ramp in an orderly fashion, carrying all this heavy weight and not slip, fall into the water.
We didn't have any problem there. When we got off, the ramp was so down, we landed in water that came up to our chins. The guy didn't put us in close enough. But
did you have to inflate your invasion belt?
We had no invasion belt.
Wow.
I had no invasion belt. None of us had invasion belts. Our helmet was upside down, and air in the top of that helmet held us up, I think. Now, when we got on that landing ship, I was the first one in there, came down that rope ladder, and the water was coming up 3-4 feet, and then down, and then up and down, and that landing craft was coming like that. So getting on it was just about an impossible thing, but we did. I was at the last end there, right by the Navy pilot. So when they came off, I was the last guy out. And when we started in line walking toward the beach, one thing came to our minds, that Germans had over 1 million landmines set in that beach. And there were other lines coming from other ships coming in. And every once in a while, you'd see a spurt of water shoot up from some guy stepping on a landmine. I made sure that I was walking in the steps of the people in front of me. And when we got to where the water was pretty hardly any there, and I could step out, I found a little burl, 6-8 inches, like sandstone, but it didn't shoot up against the German machine gun fire that was shooting at me from two sides. They were shooting from the left and from the right. These German machine guns, these were shooting 12,000 rounds a minute, like a buzzsaw.
Sure.
They were shooting in front of me, and man, I was kind of nervous then. I was smoking cigarettes then,
yeah.
And I had a waterproof cigarette holder, and I reached in and got out a cigarette. Dang, I reached in again. My matches were wet.
Oh, man.
Not 3 feet behind me, there was another soldier. So I turned around and says, "Hey, buddy, have you got a match?" I got no answer. I turned around and looked again. There was no head under the helmet. And to this day, I thank the spirit of that boy for me getting up and running. I came in at the, must have came in at the time where they were reloading their machine guns, and I ran, and then they started the shooting at me. And part of the way there, I looked up and I said, "God, what the hell am I doing here? I can't see anybody to shoot at, and they can shoot at me." But I made it to the cliff. I made it, and I thank God to this day for guidance from the soul of that soldier. Lost his head down there, back there.
How old were you?
I was a 21-year-old buck sergeant. We finally made it up. That place where we were going to go up was filled with barbed wire and stuff, and we couldn't get in there and crawl up that damn cliff. And so they got some Bangalore torpedoes, and they started putting those together, and the Germans killed at least two of the guys that were pushing them together. They finally got a charge up through that debris there, and landed up in that cleared spot so we could make it up there. And as quick as we made it up there, the Germans cleared out. They cleared out. If you get behind those fortifications, they have no protection. Their whole thing is the protection from the front. So they just cleared out.
They didn't have any reinforcements because of the operation we did with Patton and the Ghost Army.
They had nobody gardening back there.
Because Hitler sent all their tanks and most of their equipment up north because of what the French Resistance did and the false information that was given out. The Germans thought the landing was going to be farther up north.
So we got the command post set up, the G3 command post, and it was about 7 o'clock at that time, 7 o'clock in the evening. And Madison Rich, Corporal Madison Rich, and I were digging our foxholes in the sand, and I found a new litter that hadn't been used, just laying there. So I dug my foxhole a little bit larger so I could set that down in there. I planned to have my sleeping bag on top of that so I wouldn't be in the damp sand.
Sure.
And it got to be about a quarter after seven, and I just put that litter down in there, and someone said, called from the command post, Sergeant Larson, Colonel Hill wants to see you immediately. So I went in to see Colonel Hill. He was G3, a full bird colonel, and we only had two officers in G3, a full bird colonel and a lieutenant colonel, his assistant. So Colonel Hill says, Sergeant, he says, I just got word from First Army. He says, they want me to keep G3 open 24 hours a day. He says, you are going to run the night shift from now on. I haven't slept since the 4th. I was running on guts, I don't know how else to say it, or adrenaline. And I says, what time is that going on? He says, from 7:30 to 7:30. Wow.
It's a long shift.
So I went back to where I had the foxhole, and Corporal Rich was just climbing into his sleeping bag. And I said, Maddie, you could sleep in my foxhole tonight. I got that litter in there. He reached over and laid his M1 Garand rifle on my litter. I went in to work. He went to sleep. At midnight, German reconnaissance planes came over. And they lit up the sky with these little handkerchief parachute magnesium flares. And our anti-aircraft started shooting up at the reconnaissance planes. After an hour, that all quieted down. And I don't know how I spent that night. I was in another land, another world. But it came time to be relieved. And I went back to where Madison Rich was, and he reached over and picked up his M1 Garand off of my litter, and it fell in two. A piece of shrapnel from our anti-aircraft had come down and hit that gun and broke it right in two.
Wow, and that's a heavy, thick stock on that thing, too.
It's unbelievable. This story, people say, oh, did you just make that up for confirmation? On the 75th anniversary of D-Day, I was over in France. I was on Omaha Beach. I had five reporters following me and a German photographer trailing behind. After the five reporters got through with me, a reporter from Moscow came in and this was broadcast all over the United States, and I got cards from Sweden, and there was a young guy in New York that saw that broadcast, and he called his brother in New Jersey. He said, you know, Frank, he says, I wonder if that Jake Larson they're talking about is the one our dad always talked about. And finally, they got a hold of the bagel shop, because I mentioned that, and they got a hold of my son, Carl, and this guy said, you know, my dad talked about Jake Larson when he was over there, and about that, his gun being broke right in two at the landing on D-Day, and Carlin says, well, what was your dad's first and last name? My dad's name. I can't believe that getting into this this way. My dad's name was Madison Rich. And my son says, yeah, that's my dad. Yeah, this Madison Rich's son came to California and saw me because of that broadcast. So I'm reassured this isn't a made-up story. It's confirmed now. I am so blessed, Don. I'm so blessed in life. And I was blessed over there And I want to hear state that my reason for going over to the 75th anniversary of D-Day was not for my benefit. I wanted my children to go over there and see some of the stuff that I had gone through. And I wanted to pay my respects to over the 9,000 that gave their life that I could be here. I'm the only one alive. I'm the only one alive in the three different years that I was in.
Mr. Keith Anderson. So basically at this point, they're going to streamline your training and you're basically going to get the fast track and not get the in-depth, consistent training.
The fast track. It was faster than fast track. Because we found out that the 398 group had just gotten its orders to join the 8th Air Force in England. They had been serving as a year as a training group, which was training other groups that were heading over. None of them had been overseas themselves. All of a sudden, from a replacement vehicle and any training in a tactical airplane, I was being sent right to a bomb group as way overseas. And quite an acceleration. We were the very last B-17 group assigned at the 8th Air Force. Now, at that time, the last year of the war, there were 30 bomb groups in the 8th Air Force. I think there were 32, divided into three divisions, the 1st, the 2nd, and the 3rd Division. The 1st Division was B-17 groups only. The 2nd Division was B-24 groups, and the 3rd Division was a mixture of both of them. At any rate, here I graduated on January 7th, and in February I was already assigned to a bomb group as a on its way overseas. And I was very lucky once I got there. When I was there, I was assigned immediately to a crew, an existing crew. And it turned out to be the leading pilot and the lead crew of the whole group. So from the beginning of when I joined that group, I was in very select company. My pilot at that time was only a second lieutenant still, but he had over 1,000 hours of B-17 time and a lot of hours prior to that as a civilian. He was also 25 years old, which is as old as you could be to start out flight training. Each crew was assigned an airplane of its own, and immediately we went and painted ours up and named it and so forth.
Do you remember what you guys named it?
Yeah, they named it Anytime Annie after the girlfriends, one of the gunners on the crew. And the interesting thing is that we flew those airplanes over to England, and 2 days later, they were all gone, and we had brand new airplanes. Just used to supply them overseas, because they still had to go through a modification center in England to get up to snuff for combat. I understand at that time, the manufacturers would every now and again completely revamp their airplane, so, and with what they call a new model. And we had a brand new Model G, A, B, C, D, E, F, G model of the B-17. But even then, in combat, things progress so rapidly, they have to make changes. They decided they were going to make a modification to the airplane right away. They had modification centers right in England where they would send the airplane and get it prepared for combat. So they took our brand new Anytime Annie away from us, and it went to modification center, and eventually was assigned the group. And I read later that it was shot down about its fourth or fifth mission before the North Sea. So Anytime Annie didn't last too long. From then on, we didn't bother naming our airplanes. We also found out that as a lead crew, you flew special airplanes. For one thing, they were equipped with radar. All the airplanes weren't equipped with radar at that time. And they had special bomb sites and special this and that. So each airplane, each group had six or seven lead airplanes, and then the lead crews would fluctuate flying those lead airplanes.
Now, I understand you quickly learned there was a disadvantage almost to being a co-pilot in a lead airplane, and when that happened, an NCO or a member higher up would oftentimes take your seat, and you were relegated to being a observer to the tail gunner. Is that correct?
Well, yeah. I soon found out, and I wasn't very happy about it, that the co-pilot on the lead crew was replaced by generally a senior officer. Our group commander was a full colonel, and he flew several missions with us, with him sitting in the co-pilot seat, me flying as a tail gunner. And I wasn't very happy about being killed as a tail gunner after I'd been spent all that time learning how to fly.
You just went from seeing what's going on to watching what just happened out the back and staring at the faces of the gentleman flying behind you. Now,
yeah, it was a good place to be because later on I saw a lot of airplanes blow up. The tail used to come off intact and flutter down on its own. And often you see one figure jump out of there and open a chute, and no chutes coming out of the main section of the airplane. So from that aspect, being a tail gunner was favorable.
From a logistical standpoint, was the escape hatch closer to the tail or to the cockpit of the plane? You could get to it quicker.
The escape hatch for the tail gunner was its own escape hatch right next to the tail gunner. So he could get out of there in a hurry. It was just very easy, just kick the hatch open and jump.
Were there any times during the war that you had to evacuate your plane or your plane didn't make it home from a mission?
We had an engine catch fire as we were climbing to altitude, and the engines had a built-in fire extinguisher system, but we actuated that and it didn't work and it kept burning, and we decided that plane was going to blow up any minute. We better get the hell out of there. So we all jumped. And I remember I was supposed to be, I was a tail gunner on that mission. So I went out the tail with three other gunners. We all jumped together. And we could talk to each other all the way down. And we did. And all of a sudden, we hit the ground. And I remember that landed a lot harder than I thought it would be. I was trying to judge when I was going to hit the ground.
Now, when you're in a situation like that, is jumping's probably not even a concern at that point. I guess you in the forefront of your mind, you're thinking, okay, this plane's going down. Either I stay here and probably die, or I jump out of the plane and most likely survive. But I guess it happens so quickly, you probably don't really get a chance to register the idea before you even jump out that plane. It's just probably instinct at that point, fight or flight.
Well, I was never afraid of having to bail out. I always figured the chute would open, and from then on it would be unknown. But so by then, you're so used to having getting shot at or getting killed in multiple ways that you're not too selective. So I didn't have any hesitancy about getting out of that airplane.
Now, when you landed, did you have the luxury of landing over friendly territory, or did you go down over enemy territory, or was it neutral?
No, we knew we were over friendly territory. We knew we were still over England, and so that was not a concern.
So once you and your two gunners landed, and you basically, I guess the first thing you have to figure out where you're at, obviously you knew you're in England, but not sure where at. How do you go about getting back home? You just find the nearest village and send out communication, or what's the process of the recovery for that?
Well, we all saw each other land, or were close enough, so we got together right away. And we were in somebody's, ended up in somebody's yard, so I knocked on their door, told them what we were doing. They said, well, there's an RAF pilot lives down the street. Why don't you go see him? So I did that. I went down there, and he was having breakfast. So he says, if you wait for me to finish breakfast, I'll drive you to my field. And he said, okay. Turns out he was a test pilot at, I forget the name of the field now. But it was their equivalent of Wright Field in this country. He took us to this field, and I phoned our base to tell them where we were. And they said they'd send an airplane down to pick us up, which they ultimately did. And
now, how many times?
While I'm there, I see these airplanes taxiing by with no propeller. And a lot of heat waves coming out the rear. Well, I'd never even heard of a jet airplane by then. Never even heard of them that I remember. So they were the first English jet. And I forget the sequence of events by then. But by then we knew that the Germans had a jet airplane, whatever that was, and we should see them occasionally. And here was the British answer to the German jet, but they were way far behind.
It was the Gloucester Meteor, I believe, was the first British
jet. It was the Gloucester Meteor. It was English airplane.
What was your impression when you heard that thing take off? Because clearly the audible output of a jet engine is far, far superior than that of a prop plane. I mean, just the noise those things put off. What was your first impression when you saw that thing taxiing out on the runway?
Well, it didn't make a lot of noise taxiing, and it took so long to take off that they were practically out of sight down the end of the runway. By the time they got off the ground, you couldn't hear them anymore. So I didn't have any impression at all.
No, I got you. Now, I understand you flew about 7 missions or so as a tail gunner. In that time, did you ever have to engage the enemy with your machine gun?
No, I never had to actually fire that machine gun. I did fire it at airplanes so far away that I could barely see them, just so I could say I'd shot at a German airplane. But
sure.
No. Now, another thing I should explain. When we first got over there, then the 8th Air Force had developed its tactics pretty well. And they'd finally settled on 36 airplane group as an ideal bomb group. 36 airplanes in a formation.
Yeah, I believe in a past interview you said you guys had 12 ships to a squadron and 3 squads to a group.
We flew with 4 squadrons. You had an echelon of 3 airplanes and 1 tail. You had a V-plane, right wing, left wing, and tail. That would be a 4-plane unit. And with the 12 group formations, we would fly 4 of those. Pretty much after D-Day.
Now, speaking of D-Day, I understand that right around Operation Overlord, that the 600th Bomb Group participated in bombing and attacking coastal defenses of the enemies on the Cherisburg Peninsula. Did you participate in that during D-Day?
We were bombing the beach. We carried 100-pound bombs that day, and they were designed not to blow up things as much as to create foxholes for the infantry to have something to jump into.
Yeah, that's what a lot of people don't realize. Part of the strategic planning for the D-Day invasion was to have you guys lay bombs onto the beach to create craters, as you just said, to allow the gentlemen to get below the surface line to get take cover from the enemy machine gun fire.
That was our function of our group. Now, different groups had different functions.
Sure.
Now, D-Day, we flew just 6 ship formations. That was the only day time I ever flew in a 6-ship bombing mission.
Was the flak fire real bad on that day, or were they pretty much caught off guard?
I did see a burst of flak in the sky that day. We were concentrating on any heavy enough artillery they had available was concentrated on the shooting at our fleet, our invasion fleet. We were just a nuisance as far as they were concerned.
Now, speaking of flak, the first time you experience flak, what can you compare it to? I mean, probably very little. I mean, is it like, obviously you have shrapnel penetrating your plane, but when those bursts go off, do they create blast waves that create turbulence, or is it just simply the shrapnel penetrating your plane?
An 88 shell would blow a plane apart. They had 88, 90, and 155, I think. So even an 88 shell could do more than just create the fragments, the shell fragments. It would just blow a whole airplane apart, or blow the nose off, blow the whole airplane up. Flak did a lot of different things.
But luckily, for the grace of God, during D-Day and during your mission to provide foxholes for the upcoming landing invasion, luckily you guys didn't have to deal with flak. Was for you on that day, was it pretty much a straightforward mission, or did you guys have any issues that you had to overcome?
No, it was pretty much a straightforward mission. We didn't even get shot at. I don't think we saw a burst of flak in the air even.
Those are the missions that you mark down as the best ones to go on, obviously, because you get out there, you do what you're told to do, and everybody gets home safe, and you get to fly in another day.
Yeah. In fact, originally we were going to fly 2 missions on D-Day. For some reason, they called off the second one, so we just came home and turned on the radios and listen to how the invasion was going.
This has been a Digital 410 production.